You're listening to Artbeat on RTR FM 92.1. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'm talking to one of Australia's most influential cultural advocates. Esther Anatolitis is...
Anatolitis.
apologies, Esther. I should have checked that. Is a leading voice for the arts. She talks about the ways that culture shapes us as a society and the benefits of making sure that our politicians have thought through why and what they are doing when it comes to cultural policy in Australia. Esther, welcome.
Hello, it's great to be here.
It's so great to have you here and to talk to you about this. I have just found your work so fascinating and has really, I'm not exaggerating, this is not hyperbole, I have had some epiphanies over the last few days. So thank you for that.
Oh, how brilliant.
One of the things that you have been writing about is that this, while money is great and it's great to kind of look out for what parties are funding the arts, we shouldn't be looking at the amount of money or the amount of funding as the sole measure of a party's commitment to the arts and culture. Why is that? What else should we be looking for when it comes to policies from political parties?
I think it's a really important point to distinguish the dollars from how they actually get out there. And there's so many questions to ask about this. So if a party is supportive of the arts, have they got some kind of policy that we can understand, that we can look at, that we can assess, that explicitly champions artists, that expresses confidence in how artists create the future, in how artists need to be at the centre? Or does it instead want to, you know, enjoy the arts from a point of view of patronage, of deciding what should and shouldn't get funded by, you know, prioritising certain art forms or organisations or for-profit organisations and kind of, you know, saying to the arts community, oh, look, you know, we're not interested in voices that are challenging, that are, you know, politically bold. Actually, what we want to fund is, you know, just the kind of shiny traditional things that we enjoy. So, yeah.
That are safe.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You know, we rely on artists to shift our thinking about all sorts of things, to talk about First Nations culture and rights, to talk about human rights, to talk about the environment, to talk about a range of things, but also to talk about artistic practice and what makes it difficult, what's been making it more difficult, to talk about the work that artists do in supporting health and education, in making our, you know, outer suburban and regional towns community life really exciting, but also in, you know, how do artists find places to live and work and keep making work, and to be reminding us that, of course, artists' average incomes have not changed since the 80s when extensive studies were first being done. And, it, you know, it, that is below the poverty line. You know, we rely on artists not just to inspire us and you know, move us and compel us, but also to, dazzle and rearrange our ways of thinking about absolutely everything.
And we rely on them to do that at a very low dollars per hour.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so by all means, all parties, you know, invest ambitiously in the arts. But then, yeah, tell us how your policies are going to make it possible for
us. Give us some transparency.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the wonderful things that I read was this idea that just because a policy isn't written down doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I think that that's a very sneaky way that perhaps some parties get away with like not revealing their cultural policy, by just not writing it down and pretending that that whole area does not exist. Can you give us an example of how that has worked recently?
Yeah, I think it's just it's important to keep in mind. It just raises a bar on us to really, you know, apply that scrutiny. So, for example, if a party hasn't got any kind of arts and cultural policy written down, but you constantly see their members of parliament, you know, their politicians, their senators, you constantly see them attacking artists, undermining the funding decisions of arm's length bodies and peer assessors like the Australia Council, or you see them attacking artists who are creating important political work, or you see them attacking universities, places where, you know, arts education, art schools happen, of course, universities and local governments are some of the, you know, most important owners of performing arts centres and galleries and museums in Australia. And they were both excluded from JobKeeper and the cash flow support through the pandemic. So when you see example after example of that, then it's very easy to conclude that the unwritten cultural policy is simply to weaponize the work and the voices of artists to fight some really, really silly culture war. I mean, it's just juvenile, rather than saying, hey, you know, we are confident enough as politicians in the integrity of our processes and the soundness of our policies to make sure that we fund the arts as a public good. So that question of funding the arts comes way after the policy question. We need to know that a party takes arts and culture seriously, and then you look at, okay, what's needed and how do we support it?
And how do we support things like, I guess, not only how artists live and work and what they're providing for us as a society, but also things like arts education and training, how we protect the intellectual property of artists, how we kind of set guidelines for broadcasters to make sure there's local content. These are all things that sit outside the money funding question, but that we really do need more consideration and more, I guess, thought put into from our leaders when it comes to these practices.
Yeah, completely agree. And when you've got a policy that's written down, it means that some thought has actually gone into it that has connected across education, across health. You know, people who train as artists have extraordinary career prospects. One of the really unfortunate lies that's been told around why it was okay to more than double the degree cost for arts and humanities students is that employment prospects are apparently lower. It's absolutely not true. There are extraordinary, you know, there are studies that show just how successfully artists and organisations do in employing arts and humanities graduates, but they are also graduates whose work is applied in every other industry. We need critical thinkers. We need creative thinkers. In fact, the IMF, the World Bank, some of the world's leading economists and economic groups have put reports out just before COVID about the future of work, how it's going to change. And the number one skill that's needed is creativity, thinking, you know, the ability to think, you know, outside the box. And that is what's sparked when you're trained as an artist, but it's also the mentality, the approach that is sparked when you're an audience member, when you enjoy and appreciate art on a regular basis.
If you've just tuned in, we are talking to Esther Anatoliadis. She is Deputy Chair of Contemporary Art Precinct. She's part of the team behind Collingwood Yards, and she's an Honorary Associate Professor at RMIT School of Art. She's also led a consultancy test pattern for a number of years that focuses on creative practice, policy and precincts. So you mentioned COVID and the way that it has impacted the arts and the way that artists live. It also has obviously decimated the live events sector. What do you think we should be looking for when it comes to an events insurance scheme?
Yeah, this is a good question. So we need substantial policies that are underwritten by partnerships of governments, but this is where the federal government need to take the lead because, you know, performance, music, theatre, exhibitions, they don't know state boundaries, you know, stop at the border. Successful tours rely on a national approach to be able to be financially viable. So we need to support touring companies, but also arts organisations who work with touring companies, to be able to take the risks that we know needs to happen. So there needs to be some kind of insurance that underwrites the not just the box office risk of a production or a tour not going ahead, but that makes sure that the artists and the crew and the team, the producers who actually create the work, can still get paid. And that is not only an investment in the viability of future touring, but that is an investment in the future of Australia's arts sector.
Absolutely. And I think probably one of the issues that is at the forefront of many people's minds as they start to dream of events and concerts and massive gigs coming up after the winter period. So what do you think, from all your experience in working in the arts and, you know, advocating for cultural policies that are actually effective and that bring about positive change for people working in and experiencing arts in Australia, what do you think is the secret to truly impactful advocacy for people in the arts?
Oh, wow, that is a great question. Well, I guess advocacy is best when we are all having a number of conversations in different ways, kind of, you know, all the time. And I always describe, like, compelling advocacy is when you have a conversation with someone and you connect up the point that you're trying to make, you know, maybe there's a particular aspect of policy that you're advocating for, you connect that with an experience of an artwork, a show, something that you're directly involved in or experience an audience member. So you tell that story in your unique way and, you know, because it's you who's telling it, it is going to come across as that authentic, compelling way that you speak. So you tell that story to someone and they feel compelled to have that conversation again with someone else, whether they believe you or whether they agree with you or not. I think a lot of times people hold off on having conversations, you know, ahead of election day, for example, because they think, you know, I've got to go and change someone's mind. I've got to change that person. But when we go into a conversation expecting to change someone's mind, you sort of can't help but you have this sort of tone of voice. Maybe you seem a bit judgy, preachy, naggy. And people can tell that. People have got really good bullshit detectors. So if you go into that, you know, encounter with, you know, a family member, someone down the shop, and your aim isn't to change their mind or to change them, but it's actually to just tell them something that they need to repeat again, then that is just so important. If we translate that to meetings with MPs, you know, inviting them to your studio, to see a performance, then it's about, yeah, telling them, showing them what this particular work means to you and joining those dots for them in ways that they go, right, okay, you know, this is present, this is immediate, this needs to be part of the conversation that I'm having. And, of course, you know, all the art form specific peak bodies across Australia, including the Chamber of Arts and Culture in WA, has got a whole lot of great advocacy and policy priorities on their websites. And so there's a lot of ways that you can sort of go, oh, okay, well, yeah, I can see that, like you're saying earlier, you know, streaming services, insurance, substantial increases of you know, contestable grant monies. There's all sorts of specific things to advocate for, but I reckon you've probably got, you know, we've all got a number of great ideas ourselves for things that we'd love to see, and it's just about having that conversation and getting it out there.
Esther, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you for making the time to talk to me today.
I'm so glad this worked out. Great to talk to you. And good luck, everyone. Let's change the nation.